This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For the 2016 presidential candidates, it's goodbye Iowa, hello New Hampshire. As the caucuses wrapped up last night and the contenders now have a week to make the case in the first-in-the-nation primary state. For Democrats, Iowa made it clear this is going to be a close two-person race, with Hillary Clinton apparently squeaking out a win over Bernie Sanders, while Martin O'Malley suspended his campaign. But for the GOP, Iowa's results are important, but not hugely so. Political history is full of candidates who won the hearts of Hawkeye Republicans, only to be rejected by their compatriots in the Granite State. Today in The Exchange, from Iowa to New Hampshire, let's hear from you. What's your reaction to the Iowa results, and what impact do you think they might have, if any, on New Hampshire? Give us a call. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With me in studio is Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter. Josh, thanks for being here.
Good to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Wayne Lesperance, professor of political science at New England College, director of the Center for Civic Engagement. And Wayne, welcome back. Good to have you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And joining us from Iowa, Dennis Goldford, professor of political science and Flansburgh Fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy at Drake University. Dennis is co-author of The Iowa Precinct Caucuses, The Making of a Media Event. And Dennis Goldford, good to have you too. Thank you.
Good morning.
And joining us for a few minutes now as we open our hour is Tripp Gabriel. He's a reporter for the New York Times. The Times calls him our man in Iowa. He's been living in the Hawkeye State for the past year, covering the race there. And Tripp Gabriel, a long night. Thank you so much for taking time out for us this morning.
Good morning.
Well, what's significant, Tripp, about last night's results?
I think there's enormous significance on both sides. For Bernie Sanders, I think a tie is as good as a win. I'm reminded of a famous headline after a football game, Harvard beats Yale 29-29. The expectations were that, and the polls indicated that Hillary Clinton would pull this out narrowly, but pull it out. And I think for Sanders to have come within a whisker at this point, and the results are uncertified at this moment, is very significant for him. And on the Republican side, obviously, the polls were pointing toward Donald Trump. Donald Trump was pointing toward Donald Trump. The Cruz campaign was acting awfully nervous in the days leading up to caucuses. A very strong win for Ted Cruz, and perhaps going back to the expectations game, an equally good night for Marco Rubio, who came in a very, very strong third place. And I think that's going to matter, particularly going into into New Hampshire for him.
Well, and just give us the latest, if you could, Tripp, on those Democratic results. You said that the state party has not yet certified those Democratic results. Tell us a little bit more there.
Yeah, in the caucuses, the state parties actually run the events rather than the state, the Secretary of State, which is usually typical in a primary. And as of this morning, the Democrats report these things in a very esoteric way. They don't just count, the number of votes for each candidate. They look at a percentage of delegates that you're going to win to a state nominating convention, which precedes the national convention. Without getting too deeply into the weeds, they're reporting, just a very small margin of a couple of what they call state delegate equivalents. There's also with Clinton in the lead by just two or three of those state delegate equivalents. There's still one outstanding precinct overnight, and there are a few delegate equivalents for Martin O'Malley, and depending on, you know, how those folks go and how this outstanding precinct goes, I mean, this could narrow even more tightly. And, you know, the parties allow themselves, I think, a 24 to a 48-hour window to certify the results. AP, which a lot of us look to kind of call the winner in these types of races, has not called it yet as well.
Well, and you mentioned the expectations game and how the narrative of the campaign in Iowa changed. The New York Times sent you to live in Iowa for a year trip to really pick up the flavor of this campaign. What shifts did you notice as time went on?
You know, every week almost there was a shift.
Really?
A year ago, I think the expectations were very strong that the presumed nominees would be Hillary Clinton, you know, in a so-called coronation, and maybe a Jeb Bush or Scott Walker, one of the very experienced, you know, governors on the Republican side. And, you know, this was a year of outsiders and anti-establishment candidates on for both parties that are really just taking over the show. And Trump has led in all national polls and in most Iowa polls for a long time since last summer, and certainly an upset in Iowa for him last night.
How did you gauge voter reaction to this Ted Cruz controversy trip over him sending out, what was it, sort of voter certifications, or the Secretary of State of Iowa is watching you and making sure that you're voting and grading people's voting history? Just explain that to us, if you could. That came in at the last minute, and it upset a lot of people, including the Iowa Secretary of State.
The Cruz campaign sent out a kind of a mail piece that, and there's a history of this, basically from both parties, trying to shame the people who were not regular voters into turning out, and they actually sent, and they gave you grades. Most of them were failing grades based on how frequently you'd voted, and these were targeted at, you know, folks who were registered and enrolled but don't regularly participate in the caucuses. And the formula they used, the so-called grade people, was bogus, and there was controversy. The Secretary of State, I think, was the mail piece was headlined of the voting violation, and you know there's no such thing as a voting violation. It's not a law that you have to turn out and vote. So the Secretary of State disowned and denounced it. You know, I don't think that changed many people's views about Ted Cruz. It got a certain amount of attention in the news media and you know, social media, you know, in the last couple of days. I don't think, you know, going forward, I think people may talk about it. But, you know, the reality is Ted Cruz brought out a huge number of supporters. I mean, the turnout for the Republicans was historically high, 187,000. All the pundits and experts in the Republican Party, you know, that have done this for years, said that if any numbers over about 150,000 meant a really great night for Donald Trump, turned out to make it to be a really great night for Ted Cruz instead.
That's right. People were predicting if turnout were strong, it would be good for Trump, and they said for Bernie Sanders. And so it sounds like, Tripp, they were right when it comes to Bernie Sanders. This is a good showing for him. As you said, a tie is as good as a win, but for Donald Trump, less so. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, Trump's brand is that he's a winner, you know, that he wins all the time, and he's going to, and you know, he's coming into New Hampshire as a loser. And the degree to which that slows down his momentum, you know, now all eyes are on New Hampshire. So Trump, you know, winning Iowa is much different than winning a primary state. The Trump team acted as if they had this one in the bag. They had huge crowds in Iowa, as they have almost everywhere around the country. They said it was going to be no problem to get those people to come to the polls and vote for him. His lack of organization, his lack of management, frankly, in doing the traditional things that candidates do who have the money to run an aggressive campaign. You know, he's there's a certain Potemkin village aspect to the Trump campaign, at least in Iowa. And, you know, whether that turns some folks off in New Hampshire, whether Trump now really is seen as less than meets the eye as a candidate, I think it's going to be the major question in New Hampshire.
All right. And that's a question we'll be looking at for the rest of the hour. Tripp Gabriel, thank you so much. Get some sleep, and thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Take care.
That's Tripp Gabriel, reporter for the New York Times. He's been living in the Hawkeye State for the past year, covering the Iowa caucuses. We are looking from Iowa to New Hampshire today in The Exchange. We'd love to hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. As I said, we've got Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter in studio, Wayne Lesperance from New England College on the phone, and Dennis Goldford also joins us from Drake University. He's on the phone as well from Iowa. And Dennis, to you first, I'd love your just broad take on what happened last night in Iowa, and then we'll talk about it in terms of what it means for New Hampshire.
Organization matters in the Iowa caucuses. Ted Cruz had what was considered to be the best organization in the field. As much as the Cruz people have nothing but contempt for the Obama administration and the Obama presidency, it didn't stop them from essentially adopting the highly sophisticated turnout operation that the Obama campaign pioneered in 2008. And the Cruz people did that very well. Donald Trump seemed to try to conduct his caucus campaign from above, as it were. He had mass rallies. He didn't do the sort of retail politics we always talk about. And so Trump, I think, underperformed. Cruz really performed about where we expected. It's just Trump underperformed and Rubio overperformed. As you mentioned, again, expectations are always important. And Rubio vastly exceeded expectations, which counts, even though it's third place, as a kind of victory for him. On the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton, again, the organization made a difference. And they have to have been sweating bullets sitting there last night waiting for results to come in. But it is a virtual tie. And I think the Sanders people really thought they would win the state. So I think they have to be disappointed.
Well, you mentioned Marco Rubio. And let's talk about his third place showing. Here he is in Iowa last night making that third place showing sound like a victory.
For months they told us we had no chance. For months, they told us because we offered too much optimism in a time of anger, we had no chance. For months, they told us because we didn't have the right endorsements or the right political connections, we had no chance. They told me that we have no chance because my hair wasn't gray enough and my boots were too high. They told me I needed to wait my turn, that I needed to wait in line. But tonight here in Iowa, the people of this great state have sent a very clear message. After 7 years of Barack Obama, we are not waiting any longer to take our country back.
Josh Rogers, what do you think? Again, a third place showing, not a victory. On the other hand, as Dennis said, it looks good for Marco Rubio.
Certainly. Senator Rubio had spent a lot of time in Iowa recently and had done a good job of being in the mix without overplaying his hand, and it obviously worked out last night. One of the things that was interesting, I was looking at some of the exit polling, was that the degree to which Trump, 5%, I think, of people said in Iowa said that he best matched their values. Cruz was the person most closely aligned with the Republican caucus goers in terms of values. And, you know, listening to Rubio there, he makes this generational argument, which has been a standard one for him. That's how he started this campaign. And then for a while, he had a slightly different stump speech that was more kind of world on the brink. If we don't change things now, there'll be no turning back. Last night, he was sort of back to the more generational message. What that means for New Hampshire, we'll see in terms of does he break out of the kind of clot of people that have been in the polls trailing Donald Trump, and can he consolidate some of the so-called establishment support that has been divided between so many candidates here?
Well, and here's an email that just came in along the lines of what you said, Josh. This email from Rob says, come on, guys, let's not overdo the Trump loss. The most ultra-conservative candidate always wins Iowa, and this year that was Ted Cruz. Rob says Trump is polling comfortably ahead of New Hampshire, and a week from now, when he wins, he will be the, quote, front runner again. Rob, thanks for the email. Wayne Lesperance, what do you think?
Oh, I think that's certainly what the Trump folks are hoping for. I mean, you know, look, I mean, when you build your campaign on your brand, and your brand is that you and everyone that supports you are winners, and those who are not with you are all losers, and then you lose, you've got a problem. It's a big problem. But beyond the, you know, the second place finish, I think that you know, what a lot of stories are focusing on, and what we ought to focus on is, you know, why did he not win? And, you know, what are there structural flaws in the campaign? And I think, you know, one of the points made earlier was that, you know, that what happened in Iowa was sort of that Iowa won, right? The process won, that retail politicking, that the ground game, all of those things that we spent a lot of time studying ended up winning the day, that giant crowds don't necessarily translate into giant votes. And so, you know, Trump is facing, you know, the reality that he's coming to New Hampshire with a big lead in the polls, but to what extent does that actually translate into votes, you know, on the ground? And that's, I think, the big overarching question for those folks. To pick up on something Josh said, you know, Cruz did take the share their values win. But Rubio won when folks were asked about electability. Who do they think had the best chance of winning the White House? That was Rubio. Trump won on tells it like it is, which comes as a shock to no one. So, you know, when you're looking at when Iowans are looking at these choices, you know, they sort of split. And, you know, the conventional wisdom going in that said a huge turnout would, you know, certainly favor Donald Trump just didn't bear out. In fact, 45% of caucus goers were there for the first time. Trump won among that group, but with 30%, whereas Cruz got 23% and Rubio got 22%. So it's almost a three-way split with a little edge to Donald Trump. So as we break down the numbers and we look at you know, the specifics, we're beginning to see that things are much less clear, at least in Iowa, than the polling suggested in advance, and that a lot of pundits thought was happening, which I think is another victory for political science, because to some extent last night was about a return to normal.
Well, did you say, Wayne, 45% of caucus goers were there for the first time?
That's what the exit polling tells us, yes.
Okay. Well, in a minute, Dennis, I want to ask you about who goes to these caucuses and who does not, because that's always an issue. But while we're on the subject of Donald Trump, let's just hear how he spun this second place showing last night in Iowa. He's setting his sights in this speech on Democrats and the general election.
I will say this. I don't know who's going to win between Bernie and Hillary. I don't know what's going to happen with Hillary. She's got other problems, maybe bigger than the problems she's got in terms of nominations. But we've had so many different indications and polls that we beat her, and we beat her easily. And we will go on to get the Republican nomination, and we will go on to easily beat Hillary or Bernie or whoever the hell they throw up there.
Again, Donald Trump in Iowa last night. So, Dennis, to you, Donald Trump not sounding too upset about his second place showing there.
He was a lot more gracious than I thought he would be. But, you know, it sounds as if he'll compete in New Hampshire and then see how things go from there. But, yes, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, there was a big question all along about how good his organization was. Because we have to remember, again, caucuses are not a primary where in Iowa you would have a 14-hour window to carve out a half an hour of your at your convenience to leave home, work, or school to go vote for 10 minutes. You really have to commit to a long time. And last night there were just, with all these first-timers coming on both sides, the Democratic and Republican sides, the Republicans, as was quoted, was about 45% first-timers. Democrats, I think, were about 42%, something like that, according to entrance polls. And just the it wasn't chaos, but just the organizational problem of getting these people where they had to be at the precinct caucus sites and working it all through. It's a complicated process, and it's easy to choose not to show up, so it favors the most dedicated people.
Well, and we're going into a break, Dennis, but a little bit later, I would like to ask you a little bit more about the caucus process. I was explaining it to a friend of mine last night, and he said, how is that even remotely democratic? You know, if you've got to work the night shift, you're disenfranchised. So we will pick up on that after a short break, and we'll talk about other results from the caucuses last night. Hear some sound from some of the speeches and take your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what the Iowa caucuses might mean for New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary a week from today. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. What do you make of what happened in the Hawkeye State last night? How do you think it might affect voting here in the Granite State? We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dennis Goldford in Iowa, did you just want to pick up very quickly on this every 4 years critique of the Iowa caucuses as undemocratic because there are segments of the population that just can't participate?
Well, and I'm someone who...
I hear you sighing. I know you've been asked this before.
I'm someone who sees positives and negatives.
Sure, go ahead.
As not a native Iowan, I'm not going to flag wave on behalf of Iowa necessarily. But you have to remember that technically speaking, these, at least the way the country understands what is being shown in these caucuses, they're not really an election. They're the private business meetings of an organization, each political party. And so if you happen to be traveling to Washington for some reason, the New Hampshire Public Radio had an organizational meeting that day, you would just miss the meeting because you weren't able to get there. And it's the same with the caucuses. Yes, if you work a 3 to 11 shift, you can't participate if you want to unless you try to ask for the time off. But nobody, at least directly, is being elected to anything. The only real election technically is that delegates are chosen from the 1,681 precincts to the 99 county conventions. None of this has anything directly to do with what kinds of delegates will go to the national conventions in the summer. So, yeah, you can't participate in that meeting. On the other hand, it's not as though you're being deprived of a chance to vote in a regular election of the sorts we're used to.
Well, here's an email to that effect from Greg, who says, I find it frustrating that the media celebrates these, quote, wins and losses of the popular vote with no context about what it actually means in the bigger picture of the race. Greg says Cruz, Trump and Rubio have 8, 7, and 7 delegates each. Clinton is only 2 delegates ahead of Sanders. Quote, winning these elections only matters because the media reports it as a win or a loss, which then bolsters or burdens the respective candidates. Greg, thank you for that analysis. Wayne, what do you think?
Well, I think it's a valid point. I mean, if we were to focus on the math, you know, you'd have to come away, you know, with much more, I think, muted celebration, right? Because the numbers really aren't all that, you know, huge. It's not a winner-take-all system. It's not, you know, just a decisive victory. That it's proportional. And in the case of the Democrats, it's even. It's a tie. So, you know, that's one level. But that's just not very sexy and not very fun, right? We all want the screaming headline that says, you know, so-and-so wins. And if you surveyed newspapers this morning, what you saw was pretty shocking, I think, and important. You know, the Cruz wins headline followed by Democrats in a dead heat, or there's a tie or something along those lines, which is not what Hillary Clinton wants folks to take away. So I think he makes a valid point when it comes to the math, to the process itself. But, you know, so much of politics is about telling a story, about building a narrative, and newspapers and other media outlets help build that through these headlines about winners and losers. It's an unfortunate aspect of politics, but the horse race is a big part of it, and that's sort of what we're seeing.
Let's go to our listeners, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Thanks for that email, Greg. Let's go to a call. Mark is in Nashua. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange.
Well, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I believe Iowa got it right. They chose Ted Cruz. Just like they chose Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee. In other words, Ted Cruz at the end of the day will not be the Republican nominee.
You know, we should talk about that, Josh Rogers. Thank you so much for the call, Mark. Political history is full of candidates, Republican candidates especially, Josh, who won Iowa and then did not do well in New Hampshire. He's right.
That's true. The last person to win Iowa and go on to become president was George W. Bush on the Republican side. He obviously won Iowa, came to New Hampshire in 2000, had a rough time of it here, but then claimed the nomination and the presidency. Prior to that, in terms of people who managed to win Iowa and New Hampshire and become president, I think you go back to Reagan as an incumbent on the Republican side. You know, Democrats, it's a little different. There's plenty of people who won Iowa and won New Hampshire there. Al Gore, John Kerry, obviously neither of them became president. But the gulf between the Republican electorate in Iowa and the Republican electorate here in New Hampshire is wider, with the electorate in Iowa being heavily evangelical and much more conservative socially.
So given that history, Wayne L'Esperance, should Ted Cruz be celebrating or should he be nervous?
I think you take the win and you make the most of it, but it's one contest, right? I mean, the good news for Cruz and his supporters is that, you know, finally we actually have, you know, an election. We have something other than polls telling us what's happening, and so they'll take that and run with it. But New Hampshire's a very different state. New Hampshire voters are very independent. I think if my math is right, it's only been six out of nine last night elections in which Iowa and New Hampshire have agreed. I'd have to double-check that, but I think that's right. So there's plenty of opportunity for others to come up. Somebody alluded to this earlier, Laura. I think it's worth repeating, that really the big story, I think, aside from the Cruz-Trump dynamic, is Marco Rubio's success and what that means for the other quote-unquote establishment candidates in New Hampshire. For Christie and Kasich and Jeb Bush, New Hampshire has just become incredibly important, you know, to the point where difficult to imagine a path forward for them if they don't find a way to overcome Rubio here in New Hampshire. So, I think that it matters in that sense that some of the candidates are elevated and they're coming in with some momentum, the big Mo, and it makes New Hampshire that much more important to campaigns like those we just mentioned.
Well, and we should talk about the governors, as they are often referred to, Kasich, Christie, and Bush. But before we finish up talking about Senator Cruz and his victory last night, let's hear a little bit from his victory speech.
Let me first of all say, to God be the glory. Tonight is a victory for the grassroots. Tonight is a victory for courageous conservatives across Iowa and all across this great nation.
Again, that's Texas Senator Ted Cruz celebrating his victory in the Iowa caucuses last night. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at those Iowa results and seeing how they might play out here in the Granite State with our primary now just a week away. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Christopher in Manchester, who says, despite his poor showing in Iowa, I'm wondering if there's still a reservoir of support for Jeb Bush and the Bush family in New Hampshire. Christopher says he did well in the Trumpless debate and seems to be running a positive campaign and has loads of money on hand. Will he resonate with mainstream Republicans and some undeclareds, or what some people call independents? Christopher, thank you for the email. To you first, Dennis, how much did Bush, Kasich, Christie play ball in Iowa?
Well, you know, everybody talks this year about the establishment versus the outsider lanes. This is my eighth caucus to observe over the years. And as early as 96, I've always thought that the two lanes or the caucuses have been a two-track process. But you categorize it, who emerges as the candidate of the more conventional business-oriented Republicans and who emerges as the candidate of the more populist religion-oriented Republicans. And both tracks have been fought over in Iowa. So, for example, in 2000, George W. Bush won to a great extent because he spanned both tracks. But having gone to numerous, and believe me, they're all yours now, New Hampshire, take them. But having gone to a whole bunch of events over the past 15 months and seeing who shows up here and who hasn't, I began to wonder last spring if, in fact, those tracks have broken apart. And that Iowa is simply going to be primarily who will emerge as the candidate of the more populist religion-oriented segment of the party, leaving to New Hampshire the real beginning of the real fight over who emerges as the more conventional business-oriented Republicans.
And we did hear Ted Cruz in that sound talking about, you know, God and so forth. Josh Rogers, what about Christopher's email talking about Jeb Bush, wondering if there's still a reservoir of support for Jeb Bush here in the Granite State?
Well, Jeb Bush has worked hard in New Hampshire. He's done a lot of events. He's, you know, hasn't been easy for him. He entered the race with a lot of expectations, the sort of double edge of his family name, New Hampshire hasn't always been friendly to the Bush family. You know, it ought to be said based on Christopher's question. But, you know, he again, once you get beyond and we'll see whether the polls taken prior to Iowa really mean much. But, you know, that's what we have to work with at the moment. You know, he, Kasich, Christie, Rubio, you know, it was kind of pick 'em in most of the polls. They were within the margin of error of each other. And so, you know, anything is possible. It is hard, though, to find, you know, I haven't found that many people who are like hardcore Jeb Bush supporters. A lot of Republican voters who feel like he's a decent guy who maybe hasn't gotten his fair shot, or somebody who's been away from politics too long, or somebody who, you know, might make a good president but isn't a great campaigner on the stump, or at least, or more specifically, not good on television but better in person. You know, he's got the next, he does have a lot of money, but the next week is going to be crucial for him.
Yeah, New Hampshire is very important for him, you're saying then, Josh, as it is for Kasich and Christie.
Well, for Kasich, it's all he's got going, and you can make the same case for Christie.
You're going to meet with Jeb Bush today, Wayne, right? He's coming to New England College at 4 o'clock.
We are, just in case you thought maybe things were slowing down.
No, I never thought that.
Over the course of the next 3 days in New Hampshire, or in New England College, we have Jeb Bush today at 4 o'clock tomorrow, Ted Cruz at 10 a.m., and Chris Christie at 4 p.m. on Thursday. And so it's open to the public. Anybody's welcome. We'd love to see you. But, yeah, they're coming. They're campaigning. And I'm looking forward to hearing, you know, sort of how they tweak things to respond to what happened in Iowa.
Well, and Dennis, there's been so much focus this morning on the top three finishers on the Republican side. And we'll talk about the Democratic race in detail in a minute, too. What were the results for these sort of second tier candidates, if I could put it that way, those who didn't spend a lot of time in Iowa? I mean, did Chris Christie or John Kasich or Jeb Bush have any sort of reasonable turnout?
Well, they were below, if I recall, below 5%. Fourth place was Ben Carson, and as I watched the numbers all evening, they would sort of fluctuate to being about 10% or being 9.8% just below. But really, you saw in terms of the last results, I recall, Cruz and Trump and Rubio all having somewhere from the high 20, you know, Cruz maybe close to 28%. Trump about 3 or 4 points behind, Rubio a point and a half or two behind Trump. So they together had about 70%, 75% of the Republican turnout. And for the rest of them, again, you almost had no one, if depending upon where Carson finished, finish in double figures. And so, again, that's still part of what Iowa was about, that winnowing function. I mean, I recall in 2008, you know, Chris Dodd basically moved his whole family out here and put his kids in school out here. And Joe Biden was here, and they were done caucus night because they just ended up nowhere. So like Martin O'Malley last night on the Democratic side, they were just done in 2008. So we saw Huckabee say he's done. There's some question about Santorum. We'll see what Carson does. And, of course, those three in particular presumably would take votes out of Cruz, possibly Rubio, given their focus on conservative evangelicals.
Well, Laura, yeah, go ahead, Wayne.
No, I was just gonna say Carson is an interesting story this morning because, you know, apparently there was a decision taken for him to go back to Florida, not to come directly to New Hampshire. I think if you were in the Manchester area around 4:30 this morning, you were being buzzed by lots and lots of planes of all the campaigns arriving. But Carson wasn't one of them, and he did get 9.3% of the vote,
which is reasonable given what a big field it is.
That's right. And that's it's an interesting strategic move to not come directly to New Hampshire. He hasn't spent much time here at all. So it may be that they're going to pivot straight to another state, but we'll see. Rand Paul, 4.5%, didn't have a bad night, either. So, you know, Rand Paul is somebody that I think folks are keeping an eye on. But from what you said, or from what we were talking about, Fiorina, Kasich, Huckabee, Christie, all below 2% in Iowa, and Bush came in at 2.8%. So, you know, not great results. And again, some of them didn't spend much time. Rick Santorum, who basically lived in Iowa, got 1% of the vote. So I think the point is right that there's a lot of eyes on Santorum to see if he does what Huckabee did and ends up suspending his campaign.
Did you want to jump in, Josh? You know, I wanted to ask you, Josh, a question about you mentioned earlier the vast differences on the Republican side in terms of the electorate in Iowa versus New Hampshire. John Kasich not doing great yesterday, as you might expect, in Iowa. But from what I understand, Josh, he's doing pretty well here in the Granite State. What are the latest polls, if we can believe them or not, say about Governor Kasich?
Well, there have been a run of polls that show him in second and third place in New Hampshire, some in fourth. But he spent a lot of time there. He's approaching, I think, his 100th town hall meeting. He's made very clear that, if he doesn't do it here, it's going to be the end of the line for him in all likelihood. He's somebody who enjoys, town hall meetings and seems to have a good time out on the stump. So we'll see. I mean, he has a lot of establishment Republican support, the sort of people who some people thought might have gravitated towards Jeb Bush's campaign. Whether or not a long list of, endorsers, some of whom are kind of getting up there a bit, mean a lot in this day and age, maybe another thing. But by, the conventional way you're supposed to run a New Hampshire campaign, Kasich has been doing it and seems to be having a good time, at least.
Well, we have a quick clip of Ohio Governor John Kasich. He was in New Hampshire yesterday, even though it was the day of the Iowa caucuses. Here he is in an interview with WMUR.
I'm not a celebrity candidate. I'm just, just a governor of Ohio. So this is a place where we thought we could really gain traction, and we are.
Okay, and not a celebrity candidate. I'm guessing, Wayne Lesperance, that's a direct quote about Donald Trump.
It is, but it's so in keeping with his style on the campaign trail. He really is different. I mean, he's sort of taken a very modest, sort of aw shucks guy next door approach to his town halls and the events that he's done, which is in stark contrast to some of the other kinds of events that we've seen from folks like Trump or even Bernie Sanders. I don't think John Kasich is angry about anything, and that seems to be not the norm this cycle. So, we'll see, but yeah, I think that's certainly his point, is to sort of differentiate himself from Mr. Trump, who's leading in New Hampshire.
Let's take another call. This is Linda in Newfields. Hi, Linda, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Laura. This is a speculative question about the impact of former Governor John Sununu. Currently, his son is running for governor. And so my thinking is you can't alienate any Republican, really. But I'm wondering about his negative effect, or rather being against certain candidates, particularly Bush, since he was really fired from his position of chief of staff during the first Bush administration, and actually, I understand, was fired kind of directly by what would be the second Bush president. So I was just curious, what you think the impact for former Governor John Sununu, particularly with his position in the party as a strong titular head as well as effective head.
Lots of family dynamics stretching back. You're right, Linda. And Wayne, I know you got to go, so I'll throw that last one to you.
Yeah, I'm just not sure that there is a lot of impact there. I don't think that those dynamics really play out in a huge way. You're right. I mean, his son is running for governor, and to the extent that he can help his son, surely he wants to do that. But I don't think that those kinds of political grudges are playing out in any meaningful way this cycle. I don't know if Josh has seen more of that, but I haven't seen a lot of that.
Josh,
former Governor Sununu and Donald Trump have mixed it up a bit.
Sure.
Over Sununu's concern that Trump will doom the Republican ticket, and Trump's mentioning former Governor Sununu's exit from the White House. But I have not seen anything to indicate that former Governor Sununu has anything against Jeb Bush.
All right. And again, Wayne Lesperance, we know you got to go at the Center for Civic Engagement at New England College. Jeb Bush today at 4. Chris Christie Thursday at 4. Ted Cruz tomorrow at 10. So you'll be busy. Thank you, Wayne, so much. All right. Take care. Bye-bye. We'll be back in a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the road to New Hampshire after the Iowa caucuses. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. What do you make of last night's results in Iowa? How do you think it'll affect the voting here in New Hampshire? Again, 1-800-892-6477. With us for the rest of the hour, Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter, and from Iowa, Dennis Goldford, professor of political science and Flansburgh fellow at the Harkin Institute at Drake University. Dennis is also co-author of the book, The Iowa Precinct Caucuses, The Making of a Media Event. And gentlemen, let's turn to the Democrats now. And we talked about this a little bit at the top of the hour, Dennis, but just remind us how close it was for Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders.
It was a dead heat, although remember again, as Trip Gabriel mentioned, and he understands the strange way Democrats count their results, it's not raw numbers. It's how many state delegate equivalents at the state convention in June a candidate would get if the numbers caucus night were to hold. So it's this very bizarre system. But it was basically a couple of tenths of a point in terms of percentages of these state delegate equivalents. I think the Clinton people, for their side, have to be sweating bullets all evening. Before, nobody's actually called that race. I think Hillary Clinton came out to seize the narrative, and also she had to get on a private plane for New Hampshire to get out before our weather came in this morning. So she came out basically to claim a victory that nobody was awarding her, but it was essentially a virtual tie, and she's just never been able to, as Donald Trump would put it, close the deal here or make the deal here in Iowa. It's not that the more liberal Democrats dislike her. She would hope they would vote for her in November. It's just that she doesn't appeal to the Democratic id, if you will, those sort of deep passions of the Democrats for really a much broader New Deal than we have ever got. The Sanders people, I think, really did thought they would live. They had win. They had tremendous enthusiasm, but at least when an organizational event, you can have a really powerful fire hose, but if you can't aim it carefully, you're not going to put out the fire. And the Sanders people had all that power of a fire hose, but I think they struggled to aim it at their target more efficiently.
Let's take another call, gentlemen, and then we'll hear some sound from the Democratic campaign in Iowa. Mike's in Goffstown. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
Taking my call. Hey, listen, I know the media likes to minimize Bernie Sanders' fringe, you know, but I have to disagree with your guest who said earlier that the Sanders campaign should be disappointed in this recent example of this fire hose. The contest was essentially a tie, and if you consider the fact that just a few months ago, Sanders was a virtual unknown and 50 points down in the polls. In my view, his performance last night was nothing short of spectacular. Just read the headlines this morning. You know, he raised $20 million in January alone. This guy is just getting going, and the fact is it showed last night Clinton's old and tired, lots of baggage. She has virtually no support among young voters, and that's not a good trend for her. I think last night brought that to light. Let's see what happens next week here in New Hampshire.
What do you think's going to happen, Mike?
I think he's going to crush her here in New Hampshire, and I think that combined momentum from last night and next week is going to take him a long way. How long, I'm not sure. But I think the pundits and the media are finally starting to pay attention to this man.
Mike, thank you for calling in. Josh, how does it look for Senator Sanders right now here in the Granite State?
Well, he's been up in the polls here for some time, and Mike makes an interesting point when he raised the degree to which Senator Sanders has attracted the support of young people. I think upwards of 75% of voters under 30 participants in the caucus say they supported Sanders yesterday, and that's pretty amazing. You know, young people, you know, are you know, the rule of thumb is to think, oh, they're going to be less reliable a vote. Sanders certainly galvanized them. That's one thing that the Clinton campaign is well aware of here in New Hampshire. And, you know, the next week is going to be interesting. I mean, according to all the – Sanders has been leading the polls for some time. New Hampshire has been a place where Hillary Clinton has come back before, and the next week is going to be very interesting and very hard fought here.
How do you think the tone of this Democratic race, Josh, might change given the very close results here in the Granite State? This race has been less negative than on the Republican side, but you do start to hear both candidates kind of, I don't want to say taking shots at each other, but pointing out differences in a sharp way.
You know,
let's put that
certainly
way.
The argument from the Clinton people has been you know, what I'm proposing is plausibly enactable. What Senator Sanders is proposing is not. And, you know, we're likely to hear a lot more of that. And it'll be interesting to see what comes out in the waning moments. I mean, you look back, you know, say 8 years ago when Hillary Clinton beat back then Senator Barack Obama, you know, a lot of the focus at the end of that race was Clinton trying to galvanize women, pointing out votes or non-voting present votes of that then state Senator Barack Obama made on abortion bills where he voted present, which is neither yay or nay. And it's something you can do in Illinois that you can't do here. And suggesting that he might not be as strong on issues surrounding abortion rights as Hillary Clinton is. And that they sent out letters signed by prominent public officials, state senators, including, you know, then State Senator Maggie Hassan. This was something that caused a rift, you know, how much that affected the end result. But, I mean, things got pretty, you know, it was a close election and the Clinton people wanted to win. You know, that was 8 years ago. We're a different set of circumstances, different people running the campaigns. Hard to know, but, you know, politicians like to win elections. I mean, last 8 years ago, what Hillary Clinton was struggling against was, you know, the view that a lot of people had, which was that she was the more qualified candidate, but she wasn't as likable as then Senator Obama. Now, a lot of people would say that she, you know, you look at the polling and people voting the Democratic primary say that she has the best resume to be president and the most experience. But people find that she was the least trustworthy Democrat running in the field. And so whereas Sanders, you know, he comes across very trustworthy to people, this is all going to sort itself out. You know, to the caller's point, Sanders did well in Iowa, is likely to do pretty well here. You know, after that, it gets a little bit more complicated, the calendar and Hillary Clinton's recognition in other parts of the country and superdelegates and all that. But the next week is going to be very interesting and hard fought.
Well, while we're talking about this Democratic race, let's hear first from former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Iowa, celebrating her close victory. And as we heard earlier, you know, they're still counting, but her apparent close victory over Senator Sanders last night.
So as I stand here tonight, breathing a big sigh of relief, thank you, Iowa. I want you to know I will keep doing what I have done my entire life. I will keep standing up for you. I will keep fighting for you. I will always work to achieve the America that I believe in, where the promise of that dream that we hold out to our children and our grandchildren never fades, but inspires generations to come. Join me. Let's go win the nomination. Thank you all, and God bless you.
Again, Hillary Clinton in Iowa last night. Dennis, who was more likely to caucus for Secretary Clinton versus Senator Sanders?
Well, it's interesting. We can look at the sort of standard demographic factors, and if you looked, for example, at age, the older the caucus goer, the more likely to caucus for Secretary Clinton. The younger, the more likely to caucus for Bernie Sanders. You look at income, the higher the income, more likely Hillary Clinton. The lower, more likely Bernie Sanders. Most caucus goers tend to be 45 and older anyway. And yes, Sanders indeed did have support. He had about, if I remember, about 35% of the folks, or I should say rather that people under 45 were about 35% of Democratic caucus goers, according to entrance polls. But the 18 to 29 were about 17-18%, about half of that. So they were very enthusiastic for Senator Sanders. But again, younger folks just don't turn out the way that older people do here in Iowa.
Well, let's hear from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, also last night in Iowa. Here he is invoking the political revolution that he says his campaign is all about.
When millions of people come together, including those who have given up on the political process, they're so dismayed and so frustrated with what goes on in Washington, with young people who before had never been involved in the political process. When young people and working people and seniors begin to stand up and say loudly and clearly, enough is enough!
Again, that's Senator Bernie Sanders last night in Iowa. Enough is enough. The political revolution that he keeps calling for. Here's an email from Gary about the Democratic race, Gary in Sugar Hill. He says, Hillary had the support of big PACs, Soros, Wall Street, all the establishment Democratic politicians, all the major media, including the New York Times, and managed to get 49.9% of the vote and brazenly declare victory. Gary says, Bernie had the support of ordinary people who have contributed an average of their lunch money for a week. No PACs, no establishment Democratic politicians, no major media. And managed to get 49.6% of the vote in Iowa. Gary says this shows you can buy votes, but you cannot buy the trust of the people. Again, Gary, thank you for the email. And what do you think, Dennis? This shows sort of a very strong grassroots support. Bernie as the working man's candidate, and Gary at least sees Hillary Clinton as sort of the establishment big money candidate. That's the narrative anyway.
To some extent, yes, that's the narrative. Although when I looked at county results last night, the southern two tiers of counties in Iowa are very poor and economically distressed. And yet with just a couple of exceptions, those were won not by Bernie Sanders, but by Hillary Clinton. I think at least from the standpoint of Sanders supporters out here, because I can't judge how they are in New Hampshire. From the standpoint of Sanders supporters out here, the race between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders was one between ambition and authenticity. I mean, Bernie Sanders has his message. That message is something he states over and over and over again. That's a strength as well as a weakness. For example, when he didn't talk about foreign affairs after a direct question after the Paris attacks, he just pivoted immediately to his economic message. But it is a strength, and a lot of Democrats see Hillary Clinton as basically someone who's just her primary goal is about becoming president, whereas for Bernie Sanders, it's never been about him. It's been the message.
Let's take another call. This is Richard in Bow. Hi, Richard. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Thank you. I just wanted to bring up three points that I have obtained from personal experience. First of all, I should say that I'm a Hillary supporter. And my three points will explain why. One, when I lived in Denmark for 3 years, I was able to observe the social welfare state up close. And it was very clear that they could provide what they provided based on a taxation rate of from 55 to 72%. The more money you made, the higher your taxes were. So it was a very different kind of story than what Bernie is saying about how all this stuff can be provided for free. Nothing is free. There are high taxes that will go with it. Secondly, the Danes have a very high belief that government can solve the problems in the communities. Here, we don't have that. So you're actually thinking about funding an entity that right now has a very low acceptance rate among the public. And so the consumers who are going to consume the services provided by the government in a social welfare situation are not consumers who think that the government can do a good job. Thirdly, I worked with Bernie in the Congress, and he neither worked well with Democrats nor at all with Republicans, contrary to what he says. Putting an amendment together for a piece of legislation that doesn't ultimately get accepted or passed is not an excuse for working, saying you can work together with people. And I think that when these kinds of stories come out and when people realize what it means to be in a social welfare state, I think there's going to be a lot of reconsideration with regard to the support that Bernie thinks he's going to be getting.
Okay, so former Congressman Dick Swett from the 2nd District, former ambassador to Denmark, appointed by Bill Clinton, right?
That's correct.
Right. Well, thank you for calling in. So when you were in Congress, you're saying Senator Sanders, quote unquote, didn't work well with
no,
others.
No, and he hasn't, because he's always been an independent at best and a socialist at worst. And I think that the claim that he was able to do things with members of the opposite party, well, he wasn't even doing it with the Democratic members of the Congress. So I think these are all things that are going to be looked at much more carefully as we get into the throes of the campaign. But
what about the idea, though, Dick, that, this year people are upset with the establishment and they're, that doesn't work well with others, to you could mean to other people, is unwilling to settle for the status quo.
I think that's a very good point, and I think that Bernie has tapped into that, just as Donald Trump has tapped into that. And anybody who has the least bit on their resume of having been in the system before, which is funny with Bernie because he's been in the Congress for 24 years or some such time. So it's a little bit strange to see him campaigning as an outsider. I'm just saying that he isn't going to be able to be effective is
okay.
my bet. And,
all right.
and I think
and
that's
Dick, I
an important consideration. So
yeah,
thank
and
you.
I apologize. I got to let you go
no,
because we're
fine.
Running to the end. And, you know, Dennis Goldford, I did want to ask you about Dick's first point about the taxes. He's saying that, you know, this could be problematic for Senator Sanders in a general election.
Well, it could. I mean, you know, the word, whatever the merits or demerits of the word, strictly speaking, the word socialist in American politics has always been a dirty word. I mean, the only time a Socialist Party candidate, the high water mark, I should say, was Eugene Debs in 1912, and he got a whopping 5.99% of the national vote, and it just flatlined ever since then. Bobby Jindal would say, look, all the Democrats are socialists. At least Bernie Sanders has the honesty to admit it. So that's the kind of campaign you would get. They would wrap that socialist label around him until it was hard for him to breathe.
Well, Josh, going to be a busy week for you and for me and everybody here at NHPR. What are you going to be watching for today and tomorrow, Josh, as these candidates jet into New Hampshire from Iowa?
Well, I'm going to be spending time with Republicans today, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, Donald Trump will make his first stop as a so-called loser out of Iowa. Ted Cruz is going to be here later on, see if he can get anything going, and it's going to be a very busy week.
Well, I really appreciate you giving us our time. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That's Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. Dennis Goldford, go on vacation, get some rest, and enjoy. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
That's Dennis Goldford, professor of political science and Flansburg fellow with the Harkin Institute at Drake University. He's co-author of the book, The Iowa Precinct Caucuses, The Making of a Media Event. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy. We'll be right back.